Our final argument of the day is United States against Brewster. Mr. Hillis.
Hey, please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Defendant Appellant Kevin Brewster. Mr. Brewster raises two issues on appeal. First, the district court plainly erred when it relied on factually incorrect information to sentence Mr. Brewster to 420 months in prison. The incorrect information arose when the district court said that Mr. Brewster repeatedly forced a child to perform sex acts. As a matter of due process,
Mr. Hillis, the problem I have with your argument, beside the fact that nobody ever complained to the district judge, is that it seems to be based on the idea that all force is physical, that psychological inducement can never be force. Is that so?
Your Honor, that's not the point of my argument. My point of my argument is that
the district judge used the word force.
Yes.
The evidence shows that your client used psychological inducements, and you can't go out to play with your friends until you do X. Why is it inappropriate to describe that as forcing a six-year-old to do something?
Pages 78 and 79 of the transcript, which the government itself refers to on pages 12 and 13 of its brief, shows that the district court was considering two separate matters. The district court did indeed address repeated force, and then subsequently in its reasoning, the district court addressed conditional privileges. The district court, therefore, by record, showed that it regarded the two things separately, and so there's the argument, Your Honor. And if the district court wished to engage in the sort of description, if it's to be considered that, about conditional privileges, then I don't think that the district court should have explained it in this fashion.
And I don't understand this. What are you referring to as conditional privileges?
Conditional privileges were the sort of things that Judge Easterbrook was mentioning.
Nothing I said had anything to do with conditional privileges.
District court did, in fact, in the record, refer to going out to play and only if the daughter performed sex acts. There's a note that was in the record about, Daddy, can I go out and I promise to do the following sex act if you let me do it.
So that's what you're referring to as conditional privileges.
Indeed.
And that was just force. Psychological force of a young child.
I believe that that would cause a problem under this court's...
And even if it is mentioned in two different places, I don't see what difference it makes.
I don't understand why we would refer to two different things if we don't mean them differently.
He can characterize it however he wants. It can fall into two categories. I don't get that argument.
Or two words for the same thing. I mean, what you're looking at is the fact that oral expressions tend to be a little laxer than written ones. The idea that a judge making an oral statement of reasons would never use two words to mean the same thing strikes me as not a sound understanding of how people speak.
Your Honor, I don't have a problem with understanding how people speak. I'd rely instead on this court's own decision, United States versus Durham, which says that if the sentence is based on potentially incorrect information, then we have a problem.
This has nothing to do with incorrect information. It has to do with how the judge described what's basically undisputed information.
I believe that the dispute is about the nature of the reference to force, and therefore under Durham, I think that we have an argument, whether it's a winning one, Your Honor. I don't believe that I need to proceed further on this. I've made my argument. I rely on Durham. I rely on the transcript. Pages 78 and 79 certainly provide support for us to make the argument. I'll turn, though, instead to the second argument. And in the second argument, Mr. Brewster contends the district court abused its discretion when it imposed special conditions of supervised release, subjecting him to polygraph testing, restrictions on where he can go, who he can communicate with, and accessing sexually stimulating, sexually oriented materials. The third issue has been addressed.
Does anything turn on this, given the fact that your client has been sentenced to 420 months imprisonment?
Yes.
And that under the supervised release statute, the terms of release, if there is ever any release, can be changed at any time.
Yes. Your Honor, there's a valuable precedent to be gained. Otherwise, I assume that the government would not be going forth on its argument. So,
I assume the government is responding to an argument you've made. I am trying to figure out what turns on this. in a world in which your client has been sentenced to life imprisonment. Mm-hmm. Therefore, these terms seem to be likely to be irrelevant. And they can be changed at any time between now and the date of your client's release.
With respect to the life imprisonment argument, that is indeed why we made what argument we could about the repeated force. There was, at the time of sentencing, a 420-month sentence. There was a subsequent a state court decision that imposed a further 30-year sentence. Then we have a life imprisonment situation. So it was important to argue about the length of the sentence in order, certainly as a practical matter, to put the conditions of supervised release into play. As a legal matter, the conditions have been imposed, and so as an obligation to my client, and in keeping with the argument that we made and the potential that he gets a lower sentence or a resentencing, which would then, of course, open up the possibility of a Pepper-type argument for still a lower sentence than the 420 months that he originally received, we would have then the conditions of supervised release, which we must address because they were imposed. And in any event, Your Honor, I go to the statute, and the statute requires findings. There were no findings that were made under 18 U.S.C. 3583D 1 through 3. That is a problem for the government. That is a problem for the conditions to be considered valid by this court. Even if the conditions had been appropriately imposed because of consideration for the various statutory factors as required under 18 U.S.C. 3583D 1 through 3 and the cross-references to 3553A and the various factors under it, we have then problems about the overbreadth and the vagueness of the various conditions, and those are continuing to be imposed by various district courts. And so there's
the value. And then on the, just going back to the polygraph, you're aware of how many circuits have ruled on this issue and completely rejected this argument that it couldn't be.
I don't believe they have rejected the argument, Your Honor, and that's why we took care in the reply brief to distinguish the government's reliance on those various cases. None of them do what the government purports them to do. And in any event, the polygraph condition, for the reason that the district court imposed in this case, would be improper because it's basically a record-keeping mechanism for the district court. It's about attendance. It's about whether you complied with conditions. It's a law enforcement tool. It is imposed upon an individual who does not wish to give the information, yet he's required to by a court order, and that implicates his rights. I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve the balance. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Holler.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. We believe that this judgment should be affirmed. Dealing first briefly with the sentencing issue, there was no factually incorrect information in this case. The question essentially is, what did the district court mean by force? Since there was no information before the district court suggesting that physical force was used, it's very logical to think that the court meant psychological force. The court follows up its statement by pointing out all of the ways that APB was forced to succumb to her father's wishes. All of them are psychological. None of them are physical. I recognize what the court says in Durham. The facts in Durham are that the court said the defendant was convicted of gun and drug offenses. The defendant had never been convicted of gun offenses. If the court had said, you know, violently, physically forced, well, this would be a totally different case. The government would be conceding. But Durham was not a case where there was, you know, plain. Durham was a case where there was a plain error, and this is a plain error case. So to the extent that there even is ambiguity, which I don't really think there even is on this record, but to the extent there is, there's no error that is plain. If the defense had stood up at argument or at the district court and said, objection, Your Honor, I just want to make clear for the record, if the court's relying on that, that's wrong and we deserve a lower sentence, okay, this would be a totally different case. The court could have said, no, I'm not talking about violent force, which it wasn't. I mean, this is a horrendous.
Right, it seems more likely that everybody understood that the judge was using the word force in the sense that children don't do these things voluntarily, and that she was coerced in all manner of ways to do this.
Everybody in the courtroom, with the possible exception of Mr. Brewster, recognized mm-hmm. that he psychologically forced his daughter to do this.
Well, and of course, that's the reason for that condition for the polygraph.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that the court,
because of his view.
Yeah, I think that that is correct as well. I think that a polygraph is entirely appropriate in this case. The courts have suggested repeatedly that polygraphs are appropriate, really almost as a general matter for sex offender treatment, but certainly in cases where defendants have not grappled with what they've done, where defendants are dishonest about their own psychological actions, and this defendant is that in spades. I mean, if the court looks at the letter that Mr. Brewster sent to the court, blaming everything on his wife, saying he was a good father, it's spine-chilling. It's horrendous, and I think that's the main reason that the state did not drop its charges and insisted on going forward even after a 35-year sentence in this case.
I have one. My question is about one of the other condition. What does it mean that Brewster can't frequent certain places? Does it mean he can't go there a certain number of times? How many times would that be? To say he can't go to places where minors congregate or associate, doesn't that depend on where teenagers might think is a cool place to be? How can the defendant predict this? I mean, that's the term that I have some concerns with.
Well, I recognize those concerns, Your Honor, and courts have grappled with that. And we've cited the cases from numerous other circuits that suggest that, McMillan and Schultz and Zobel and all of these cases, that look in that and think about that. And yet there seems to be a common understanding in the law that presumably probation officers and district court judges and defendants themselves can look to suggest what this condition means. And what this condition means is essentially that you cannot go to places where children who are going to be unsupervised or very lightly supervised frequently congregate. And what you really don't want is to get into a game, and other courts have recognized this as well, where you list off, okay, they can't go to a school, they can't go to a playground, they can't go to an arcade, and then they want to go to an amusement park, and they say, oh, it's not in there. And then we have to rewrite the condition to add that in as well. So I do think, and the only other point I would point in to you, Judge Williams, is this is a plain error case. So once again, and believe me, post-Siegel, post-Goodwin, we are doing all kinds of district court litigation about these issues, and we are focusing on and we are narrowing these conditions and we are writing them better. But to the extent that, you know, this sentence were reduced and there were some theoretical likelihood at some point that Mr. Brewster got out and served this sentence, all of that case law, all of that put together, is going to inform the probation officer in the 2040s, 50s, or 60s who's supervising Mr. Brewster and is going to be able to decide exactly what places he can or cannot go to. And on a plain error standard, which I think it would be valuable if this court were to finally say, look, there are going to be plenty of individuals who are going to object to these conditions. Mr. Hillis has 9 of these cases coming up before you. You're going to be litigating these on an abuse of discretion standard. But if in light of all these cases, defendants don't raise those issues and seem satisfied, I think it should be a plain error standard. So we believe under that standard of review, and frankly even under an abuse of discretion standard of review, that this condition is clear enough in light of established case law, in light of the other conditions. It's not unconstitutionally vague. Overbreadth doctrine, really in Kalimlin, this court suggested should be limited to the First Amendment context, and he hasn't made a First Amendment claim here. He's really only made a Fifth Amendment and a due process style claim. So we believe that this restriction does provide enough information that the defendant can figure out what it is that he can and cannot do. And that's really all that we have to do under these circumstances. As far as justification, there's plainly enough in this record to suggest that these conditions are necessary to protect the public and to deter Mr. Brewster from conduct. And that's all 3553 and 3583 require. They don't require that meticulous kind of listing, although I think district courts, in light of Goodwin and Siegel in these cases, now are making far more rigorous findings in this area. And you'll be seeing more of that coming forward. But in all of these sort of pipeline cases, you know, you're not going to see those kinds of findings. And in those circumstances, I would suggest to the court that if there is enough in the record to justify the enhancement, especially on a plain error standard, that should be enough.
That condition in one case, I forget the name of it, where the court, we upheld a condition requiring a person to refrain from frequenting, loitering, or residing within 100 feet of locations where children congregate. That would be clearer, wouldn't it?
There is no doubt that this condition could be clearer, Your Honor. I'm not going to dispute that the court could have made more specific findings. They could have done a 100-foot restriction. But even so, the defendant could litigate about exactly what kind of locations there are. Is that a church? Is that an amusement park? Is that various other establishments, stores? So the more you try to lengthen out and the more you try to write these conditions, there's still going to be wiggle room somewhere in them. And you can't write a perfect condition unless you want to write essentially a no contact ban like this court upheld in Musso, which frankly might be appropriate for this defendant in light of his conduct among the most horrendous that we see up here. But to the extent that the court was essentially saying, look, we want to give him some ability to go buy things at stores where children might work or things like that, the court did write in a commercial services exception. And the court basically is just saying he's not supposed to frequent these locations, he's not supposed to go where children congregate, and where they congregate on a regular basis. This is not to say if a bunch of children suddenly decide to, you know, show up on a public street corner in Chicago and hang out there for a lengthy period of time, he has to stay away from it. But this is really concerned with the behavior that some of these defendants do engage in, where they do go and go to parks or go to playgrounds and think about what it is they want to do and they can't do, and it gets them into trouble. I mean, that's what the literature suggests. These are valuable and important conditions that are designed both to deter future misconduct and to help the defendant so the defendant does not reoffend. And as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, that may not be too much of a factor in this case because this defendant likely isn't to get out until he is in his 90s. But to the extent that the court is, you know, writing for the broader audience of other defendants, many of whom will get out, I do think that that's something important and valuable that this court could say. If the court has no other questions, we would ask that the judgment, that the sentence be upheld and the judgment be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Holler. Anything further, Mr. Hillis?
Yes, Your Honor. I would dispute the appropriate standard is plain error. We argue that it should be abuse of discretion. My client didn't have knowledge or forewarning about the conditions. Conditions were imposed, and that brings me in a sense to an argument as well with respect to Corona-Gonzalez about why the defense didn't stand up out of its chair. There's an obligation to everybody who's in the court to correct the district court to make sure it doesn't labor under false information or a condition that would be objectionable here. And in Siegel, it's not if the defendant seems satisfied with the condition. The court has an independent obligation to review a condition, make sure that it's appropriate, regardless of what the defendant does.
Don't you think in the first instance it's defense counsel that should raise such an objection?
I do, Your Honor, but that doesn't relieve anybody else of their responsibilities, and Siegel said so. So I would rely on Siegel for that point. We need to take better examination of the conditions, and in fact, there were no findings to support any of these conditions. I think that's square one. How do we affirm something if there's no record of the necessary findings under 3583D? And that's consistent with this court's jurisprudence in Farmer and Bryant about making those findings. Due process requires notice. We have a problem because there was no notice. We have the risk of inconsistent law enforcement. Supreme Court precedent, Hill versus Colorado, says why these conditions need to be better tailored and better explained. We don't make just a due process argument. We allude to the impact this could have on an individual's right to vote, associate, attend church services, all of these things. These are beyond due process concerns. These are some things that are expressly commented upon by Senator Kennedy with respect to church going, for instance, about how it's valuable for somebody's rehabilitation to go to church. Regard that how you will, but nevertheless, these are concerns that go beyond somebody's Fifth Amendment due process concerns. They go to their individual liberties and the restrictions that are imposed on them, sometimes for very long periods up to the rest of their lives. We need to have findings, and we need to have better language. Unless the court has questions of me, I have nothing further.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.